Hey guys, welcome to the Street Cop Training Podcast. I am the host, CEO, and founder of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and today I have with me Michael Petracca, who will be sharing his story of a critical incident that he went through, and hopefully we can find some value. So without further ado, Mike, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, man. And just so you all know, if you have interest in learning more about anything that we do, check out streetcop.com. Follow us on Facebook, on our Facebook group for law enforcement, Instagram, LinkedIn, we're all over. Just type in Street Cop Training. You'll find a lot of good literature and a lot of free training we have for law enforcement officers. Anyway, without further ado, Mike, give me a little history of yourself. Maybe you could start from where you grew up and where you're from, and we'll lead into the incident that occurred.
Sure. So again, my name is Mike Petracca. I'm from West Greenwich, Rhode Island, and I work for the Cumberland Police Department. Cumberland's about 40 minutes away from me, and it consists of about 50 guys on the department, so it's not too big. And that's pretty much it.
Well, what a story.
Yeah.
So how long are you on the job now?
So coming this January, it will be the start of my third year. So two years. Cool.
So you're quite young when this stuff happened as a police officer.
Yes. So I was only, it happened May 9th. I got sworn in on January 6th. So I had just finished FBO. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't want to ask any questions that are going to make other people look bad. Did you feel like you were prepared to encounter a situation like the one that you encountered?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I think being so early in my career was probably one of the things that helped out, because all that training that we just had in the academy and all the stuff you learn on FTO, you know, distancing yourself, you know, watching people's hands, this and that. I mean, I did end up getting hurt, but like I said, having all that fresh training, I think, is what probably kept me alive, kept me calm, because we drilled, you know, certain scenarios in the academy. And I think that's that ended up helping out in the long run.
It's refreshing at times to hear that an academy is actually doing some good work.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they have put some thought outside of what the curriculum requires to ensure that you guys are going to be prepared to, you know, encounter situations that are almost inevitable in this career. Anyway, so the day that this incident occurred, did you feel like there was anything different in the air? Or you went to work just feeling the same like every other day?
Yeah, just went to work. You know, everything felt pretty much normal. Nothing eerie up until the point where I came in contact with the person who inevitably stabbed me.
So let's hear about the story. Go ahead and just take it from what you were doing. You're in patrol, the dispatch, what occurred. You tell it.
Sure. So the event took place on May 9th, 2020. It was the day before Mother's Day. And that's, you know, a day I'll never forget, because I had to call mom and let her know that I was in the hospital, which was kind of awkward. But the events leading up to that, it was around 7 o'clock at night. But even before that, let me start. It was normal, you know. Pretty run of the mill. I was working the south end of town, taking calls. The guy in the north end of town ended up using his comp time to go on a detail, construction detail. So I got bumped to his area, which wasn't an issue, but something that's important, you know, towards the story was while he was still working in that area, he got a call for service for a suspicious person in the area. He was in a coffee shop and he was just acting kind of, you know, out of place and whatnot. I don't remember specifically what he was doing that made people call police, but they originally didn't find him. He took off on foot and, you know, there was no charges or anything like that. It was just a suspicious person. So I ended up taking that area later on in the night and not even really thinking about that, just doing property checks. Ended up behind the Cumberland High School. And that's when I came into contact with the individual. And if you were to like give a description, like a generic description of what you would say is like a suspicious person, I feel like this guy fit the bill. Like
just a strange looking weirdo.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, down to the clothes, the way he was looking, you know, everything, his mannerisms, the whole nine. He was in a trench coat. He had the combat boots on. He had a backpack, a beanie, He was wearing like these orange tinted glasses, goggle looking things. Just a strange guy. And he was going through trash cans, but not like rummaging through them for like, you know, food or clothes or anything like that. He was going through like recycling bins, and he was reading the spent worksheets that were in the high school's trash. So
weird. Yeah. Weird stuff.
Yeah. And then it was strange because when I rolled up on him, he was completely unfazed by the fact that there was a marked police car, like right next to him. And then I got out, you know, full uniform and everything, called out. And, again, he was completely unfazed by the fact that, you know, there was a, you know, uniformed police officer standing there, and, completely didn't acknowledge the fact that I was there until I started talking to him.
And what was his demeanor like? Was he confrontational? Was he seemed like he was off?
Definitely seemed like he was off. At first, it wasn't necessarily confrontational. Definitely that 1,000-yard stare, you know, kind of looking right through you. Creepy look. Definitely had the hairs on the back of my neck standing up right when I came into contact with him. I kind of knew that something was off, which is why I was like right on the radio. I wanted people to know where I was, who I was dealing with. So,
were other people coming your way once you let them know?
No, I don't think so. Not right away, at least. I do know later on after speaking to rescue personnel that they waited because they scanned us. They were waiting until I cleared before they went back to their station. They were pretty close to the area. So when I did eventually get hurt, they were there quick. Everyone was there quick though. So to be honest with you, I don't know if people started to float in my direction, but, I don't think initially that was the case. So,
were there any other guys on patrol, like any other officers available?
Yeah. Yep. So our minimum man is three guys on the road. We ended up going minimum man when that guy went on a detail, but he was still, you know, on duty. He was just, you know, confined to his detail on a different end of town, but he ended up coming down as well after the fact.
Did he have the detail he was on? Did he have a patrol car to respond with?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, cool.
So in speaking with this guy, you know, I just, you know, asked him the normal questions like, you know, where are you going? What are you doing here? How'd you get here? And whatnot. That really makes sense. And again, going back to kind of the academy preparing you for, you know, going on patrol and be on an FTO and, you know, listening to those guys, you can hear them in the back of my head telling me like, this guy was telling me like, oh, come here. Like, I got to show you something. Come read these papers that, you know, I just pull out of the trash. I'm like, no, thank you. I don't have any interest in whatever it is that you have to show me. You know, I was being polite with them, but I just wasn't getting closer. Like I said, I could hear, you know, FTOs and the guys who trained me in the back of my head being like, oh, don't even think about getting close to this guy because he's a total creep. So, in speaking with them, somebody, the guy who was on the detail that was working the north end of town, came over the radio because he knew that I was out with a suspicious person. He had that call for service earlier in the day. So he knew that there was a possibility that it could be the same guy. So he asked, you know, what's the description of the individual? And, one thing that I wish I probably did different in this whole thing was, keep him out of earshot. But I mean, he heard it. There was nothing that I could do with the fact that he heard my radio. So I just, you know, was up front with him. I'm like, hey, man, listen, you're not in any kind of trouble or whatever. We just had somebody, you know, earlier in the night. And I gave the description of him, you know, the combat boots, the trench coat, backpack, beanie, glasses, whatever. And it was at that point when, you know, he really gave me a really creepy look. And, I told him again, I'm like, listen, if you need help, whatever, you need a ride, whatever it is, like, you know, we're here to help you. You're not in any kind of trouble. You know, it is what it is. And before, you know, I could get the wants and warrants check back, he just took off running. And, again, I was 5 months on the job. I thought it was cool. It was like, oh, this is my first foot chase. So I started sprinting after him and, eventually caught up to him. And it's pretty unclear whether or not he fell or he was trying to pull on a knife or whatever it is that he was doing. But he ended up falling down in front of me and I stepped over him because we were both running full speed. And I thought because he had hit the ground, a limb, an arm, a leg, or whatever it might be, swung up and hit the inner thigh, my inner thigh. It turns out it wasn't. He actually pulled a knife out of his waistband. And as he fell to the ground, he turned around and he stuck it into my leg. Which, again, I didn't know immediately. I didn't know I had been stabbed until he actually pointed it out. So after I fell or stepped over him, he was on the ground. You know, I saw the knife in his hand, but because it went in and out so fast, it was still clean. There was no blood on it. I drew down on him and I told him to, you know, drop the knife, get down to the ground. And he pointed at me and he's like, oh, actually pretty creepy. He was like, oh, now you have hepatitis. I don't have hepatitis. I get checked out and everything. So that's good. And he was like laughing.
Yes, that's important.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was like the first thing we did once you get to back to the hospital was some blood work. But yeah, he started laughing and he pointed. And I was like, what did you just say to me? And he, you know, pointed further at my leg. And I looked down and it was an arterial bleed. It wasn't the femoral artery, but it was hemorrhaging blood. And I get stabbed on my right thigh, just about as high up as you can get into the groin area. So there was some, he missed some pretty vital stuff, which is good. But again, that was the most blood I had ever seen. Even to date, that's the most blood I've ever seen.
Did you have a tourniquet on you?
I did in a cruiser, which was a big mistake.
Why? On my part. Yeah, why would you do that?
It's Murphy's Law. I always had the tourniquet in my left pocket. In the academy, we always kept it in our left pocket. Got on the road and I kept it in my left cargo pocket, and for whatever reason, I don't know if I was doing the laundry, it just never made it back in my pocket. So I have a tourniquet on me now, and that's something I preach to everyone that I come in contact with, to absolutely 100% keep a tourniquet on your person.
Yeah, so we have a class called Life-Saving Medical Tactics where our instructor, Sean Barnett, and the first thing he goes over is, are you carrying a tourniquet? What kind of tourniquet are you carrying it? And where are you carrying it on your body? So he will actually run people through drills in the beginning of class to show them the importance of positioning that tourniquet on your person in case you lose functionality in one of your limbs to be able to get to it. So yeah, man, I think guys should really consider, and girls who are listening, that when you're getting geared up, it's no different than making sure you have your gun is to have your tourniquet as well, because we've interviewed a lot of people and people have employed them and they do save lives. So it's a tough lesson to learn. And I'm sure you were in a fucking panic when it happened. You're like, oh my God, where's my tourniquet?
Yep, absolutely. And that's exactly what happened. So I did lose pretty much all of control of my right leg when that happened. And I was about 100 yards away from my cruiser. So I ended up having to drag my leg behind me to make it back to my cruiser. And you know, I just dumped my duty bag in the front seat of the car. And I mean, luckily it was right there, but again, I lost my boot in the process, just dragging that leg behind. And somebody else on the podcast said it. It was bleeding to the extent like if you were to take a gallon of milk and just turn it upside down. That's always how I explained it. And it was funny to hear somebody else explain it just like that. But that's exactly how it was. It was just blood like I had never imagined would come out of someone's body like that before. And it was the tourniquet that did eventually save my life. So
did you after, now I don't know if I missed this part, but did you actually draw your weapon and fire at him?
Not at first, no, because I didn't realize I had been stabbed. After he pointed it out, there was a little bit of that you know, OODA loop effect. I was trying to, you know, my first thought was direct pressure. Obviously that wasn't going to work because of the amount of blood where I was stabbed, there was just no way. But, you know, again, that was my first thought. And as I was trying to, you know, stop myself from bleeding just by holding it, he had taken off on foot. And then I had looked up and he was running away. And to me, that was the scariest part, because here's somebody that just stabbed me. I thought for sure that he hit the femoral artery just because of where it was. I thought I had like a minute before I was going to bleed out. So my thought process was, this guy just more or less killed me and he's running away, and I have to shoot because, you know, I'm not going to get another shot. He's still got a knife. You know, what's he going to do now? It's crazy the amount of thoughts that can go through your head in such a short period of time, and then how much things can actually slow down as far as, you know, the perception of time goes. So I did draw my weapon, and I did fire 5 shots in his direction. He had probably made it a decent, he made it a decent way away. It was probably about 40 yards away before I actually, you know, started shooting. And I managed to hit him once because he was running perpendicular to me. So it was okay. Still kind of center mass, but I ended up hitting him once in the arm, and then one hit him in the leg, which ended up breaking his femur. So he went right down.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep. Snapped it right in half. So he went right down the second that the last shot
hit. Shot, dude. What a lucky shot.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Super lucky. And like I said, he went right down. And at that point, you know, I knew that, yeah, he was, you know, not getting away at this point. So it was time for me to get back to that cruiser and find the tourniquet and tourniquet up. So I was on the radio the whole time from the second I got out of the cruiser, you know, just talking to the person. I was calling out descriptions, this and that. And then once the guy started taking off running, I was on the radio, you know, call outs, directions, you know, where he was going. Something that we drilled in the academy that ended up helping, you know, they would smoke us in PT and then they'd have us run after someone and, you know, do a simulation of a foot pursuit, which ended up helping because everything felt like second nature.
Sure.
You know, I really didn't have to think much about it. And then even after the fact, you know, the shooting, it all, everything just came into play by pretty much itself. And it's a miracle that it did happen that way, but I really surprised myself and, you know, what people can do when you fall back on that training.
Well, that's a good point that you make because I emphasize this nonstop, and hopefully people who have influence in academies are listening to this, is that here's a proven point of what we're advocating for academies to undertake. Something very simple, literally just clicked in his muscle memory for you. And essentially you did a much more significant job because of the training that you had. So it's an excellent point, man. You're really making some solid, significant points here. And for those who haven't had training like this, you can create training like this. You can, in your mind, think about what it's going to sound like, what it's going to be like. Let these scenarios continue to run through your head as a police officer, because when it happens, you already have a plan in your mind of what you're going to do when that shit happens. And you can't plan for everything, but when you plan for 100 different things, they'll kind of mix together. You know what you're going to do if this happens. You know what you're going to do if that happens. What's it going to sound like? What makes the most sense? What are you going to do? And how are you going to save yourself? And being prepared is very, very important for law enforcement. Anyway, carry on, Mike.
No, I mean, I completely agree with that. And having these experiences so early on in my career has completely changed, you know, my outlook, well, really everything in life. But even the job, doesn't matter what kind of call I go on to, whether it's just, you know, your 900th alarm call that week or whatever it is, I still always have a mental, you know, like a plan as to what's going to happen. Where am I going to park the car? You know, shit ends up hitting the fan. What is the plan? So I think,
dude, maybe this whole thing was a blessing in disguise, because people literally start to get lackadaisical after years of, it being uneventful. They tend to forget that the potential for some real significant circumstances, they think it diminishes, but it stays present. I mean, we've interviewed people from desolate areas of the United States, very rural places where nobody's ever been shot. No shots been fired. They've been shot 6 times. So anybody who's listening to this needs to just be reminded that it is a very dangerous job, and you must treat it as such, even in an off-duty capacity, or working an off-duty capacity or an extra duty or a traffic job, whatever it may be. We've seen it, cops getting ambushed, you know, and it's not going to change. It's not going to stop. Every year we'll have somewhere in the ballpark of 400 police officers killed in line of duty. And hopefully things like this will mitigate that number and reduce the likelihood of anybody giving themselves the vulnerability to be put in a situation like that. So there's a lot of value in what you're saying for a guy who's 3 years on the job who learned some fucking tough lessons. Unfortunately enough, those lessons will probably keep you protected for the remainder of your career. And I'm hoping that you can pass that stuff on to other people who are willing to listen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we, as a department, you know, before the events happen, and still even sometimes in some cases with certain individuals, they probably are still complacent, but beforehand, we haven't had any incidents like that in probably 50 years. I think it was the last case where there was an officer involved shooting. So people definitely were complacent. And after the fact, we got tourniquets for the guys in the department, which was great because there was people that didn't even know what a tourniquet was or how to use it.
You know, it's wild to me, dude, is this is the one thing that just, especially about law enforcement, but it's the same thing in the world, is I don't know why we're not forecasting what could happen and preparing for it. Every time you got to wait till something happens and then they'll make the change.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a little absurd. And, you know, unfortunately, I understanding the mentality behind some of these administrations, I have to just understand they don't have the know-how to prepare for these things. And, you know, that's where we come in as a company, is to try to really guide other law enforcement agencies. I'm like, this is important. You should know this. You guys need to know this stuff. This will help you. This is foreshadowing or forecasting what could happen is an important thing to make sure that your people are well. Knowledge of the law will prevent embarrassment and lawsuits. So yeah, man, I mean, you're really making a lot of good points today. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. So kind of going back to the story. So, you know, I remember, you know, just hemorrhaging blood, making it back to the cruiser, and then just dumping the duty bag out to find that tourniquet. Sat down on the ground and, you know, the blood started to pull up around me, but I really had no other option but to wait at that point. But big shout out to the guys that I was working with for getting there so quick, because they were fast. Even the neighboring town, which would be Lincoln, they responded super, super fast as well. They were scanning and they were right there. Critical incident like that, everyone likes to come and help out. And then, like I was saying before, rescue.
Great. As they should.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And rescue was there super quick as well. So there wasn't a whole lot of time where I had to sit. And, you know, at that point, I was pretty much bleeding out. So it was nice to have backup come so fast. So yeah, I was picked up by, you know, the rescue, which again came super fast. And then I was just taken to Rhode Island Hospital. They did whatever procedures they had to do, give me whatever, you know, drugs they needed to, and they put the sutures in. And I found out after the fact that I have a bleeding disorder as well. So
that was
pretty interesting to have to deal with. I lost quite a bit of blood, and I guess part of this bleeding disorder I have is once you start to have an arterial bleed or a big bleed like that, it's hard to get the body to stop bleeding.
Well, it's like some kind of like anemia type of deal?
Yeah, it's the pretty rare thing. I don't know exactly what the specifics of it are. They gave me pills for it after that I keep in my duty bag. And I have like a little go bag down just in the event something were to happen. And it's just chew a couple pills if you you end up bleeding.
Wow. What kind of let's talk about you, and then we're gonna go back to the suspect here. What kind of recovery did you have from that long in the hospital? Did you have to do PT after that? Physical therapy?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So even still, I, you know, my leg's not quite as strong as the other. I came back and it was important for me to come back. I think that's the case with a lot of guys, to get back as soon as possible. I was originally asked to come back the following Tuesday, which was way too soon because I had an open wound and it was still getting packed. But the road to recovery took about 4 months, and it was a pretty gnarly road to recovery, because after being in the hospital, I had infections that started. So like even a week after, you know, they had to cut that wound back open.
Jesus.
Yeah. It was awful. That was probably the worst part of it, was the doctor's appointments and having to go back, and, you know, because the wound wanted to heal from the top or the outside first, and it wasn't healing down. It went 4 inches into my leg, ended up hitting the bone. So
wow.
Yeah.
Jesus. So
that cavity didn't want to close in the inside of my leg, just wanted to close on the top. So every week I'd have to go to back to the doctors. You know, I was getting it packed daily as well. I had a visiting nurse come, and I was lucky enough to have my girlfriend too. She was able to pack my wound. She's also a nurse, which was great. But
I'll figure cop and a nurse. Never heard of such a thing.
Yep. So yeah, they kept having to cut it open, and it was a long road to recovery. And then after the fact, when it finally did close, I had some PT to do, and even to this day, I still have a little bit of nerve damage going on, and it's, like I said, not quite as strong as it used to be, but I'm starting to get back into the swing of things, and I'm at the gym, and I'm able to do legs again, which is nice, and I haven't been able to ski in a few years, which was big for me. I like skiing, and hopefully this year I'll be able to do that again. So pretty much a full recovery at this point, but still working to get the strength back to where it was.
So what happened to him?
So he was also loaded into rescue. You know, the first guy on scene came up to me like right away, as you would expect. And I told him, I'm like, listen, like, there's nothing you can do. I already have a tourniquet on at this point. Like, go. I remember being nervous that we weren't rendering aid to him. I don't know why. So I said, go, you know, render aid or do whatever you have to do. Take him into custody. So we took off running. He took him into custody. He was then loaded into the ambulance. We actually had the rooms next to each other in the hospital when we first got back to the emergency.
Oh, that's fucking weird.
Yeah, it was. It was an eerie feeling knowing that he was right next to me and whatnot. But he had to get like rods drilled into his leg because of that femur that broke. So we could hear the drill from the room over, which was pretty interesting. So they patched him up. With the exception of the rods and whatnot, he was probably out of the hospital before I was. I had to stay overnight again because of that bleeding disorder, and they wanted to monitor everything. And then he turned out, or we learned after the fact, that he was schizophrenic. So as of right now, he is in a mental institution, and he's still waiting to face trial.
Is he being charged?
Oh yeah. Yep. He is being charged.
Wow. So he's still in a mental institution as per the current moment.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because he does call my detective captain usually once a week or once a month, whatever it is. And he asks for us to drop the charges.
You know, on what regard though?
I think that probably goes toward that being mentally unstable. I don't know if he really believes that we would drop charges for something like that, but he still tries.
And you guys are in Rhode Island, so you guys are conservative state. That's a good thing.
Yep.
What kind of charges has he been charged with?
It was assault with a deadly weapon, and there was no attempted murder or anything like that. It was, you know, assault against a police officer and stupid stuff like carrying a blade over 3 inches and stuff like that.
Does he have a previous criminal history?
He does. It was nothing too extensive, so it's kind of interesting that he had some other run-ins with police, including our department, in the past for being a suspicious person. It was actually probably a month prior. We had him at Taser Point for stealing from a Cumberland Farms.
That's interesting. So he's a little touched.
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. And I kind of wish we knew more about him in particular, and that's why I think it's important. Like, I go into the station every day, and you know, I read the dispatch log, and I try to know what's going on in town, just in case I do come across these people. I have an idea of what I'm dealing with. I think that's important. And sometimes we go into roll call, and certain supervisors like to skip that, but I think it's important that you know who's in town, what's going on, and whatnot, so you can prepare yourself for, you know, the people and, you know, whatever it is that you're going to run into that day.
Dude, I agree. I mean, really should have a good idea of what's happening in town is 100% important. Mike, is there anything else that you think that you could offer to anybody outside of the value that you've given already that maybe other people could take and use right now?
Yeah, I guess to a certain extent, and I know we touched on it already. Something that, you know, really hits home to me is having that tourniquet. You know, I preach it a lot. I talk to a lot of guys on my department. Know how to use it as well. Don't just buy a tourniquet and, you know, just throw it on your belt. If you don't know how to use it, then it's not going to do any good. So definitely have a tourniquet. I have mine on this pretty cool, like, holster bracket thing. So it goes right in front of my gun on the holster, and it hangs there. It's in the same spot all the time. I know how to use it. I've trained with it. And that's another thing too. If you're going to buy one of these things, just like a weapon, you got to train with it. And I think that's something that we should probably implement into our, you know, firearms training, because they do go hand in hand. You're not going to, you know, more than likely you're not going to use your tourniquet unless your gun's out. So I think that because they go hand in hand, it should be trained together. So again, that's my big thing. That's my spiel. I like to preach the whole tourniquet thing, because
I mean, I think it's a good idea to, even in the academy, you know, to be practicing with tourniquets, and those tourniquets should probably be a good choice tourniquet that everybody remains with people throughout their career. You don't want to train on a tourniquet and then get issued a different one.
Right.
You got to train on the tourniquet that you're used to using. That's a very important thing that I want to remind people.
Yep. And I recommend the CAT tourniquets too. And don't buy any off brand stuff or cheap out. You know, they're not the cheapest thing in the world. They're like 35, 40 bucks. I mean, they're not expensive, but, you know, Amazon might sell for 10 bucks, but you don't want to buy any of the Chinese copies. You want the actual North American Rescue CAT tourniquet. You know, I'm not, you know, affiliated with them whatsoever, but that particular product legitimately saved my life. So I definitely recommend it.
We actually have a tourniquet and an IFAC kit that we sell on our website that's recommended by Sean Barnett, who is a paramedic instructor. He's flown 75 combat missions, support of special forces, and he will, in his courses, give you a good recommendation. I don't know exactly which one he refers to. I don't know if it's the same one, but we do have it. And we actually have a discounted rate from the manufacturer to us. So if you're looking to get yourself a good tourniquet, this was hand-picked and hand-chosen, and this small IFAC kit from Sean Barnett, who teaches our course on life-saving medical tactics. But hey, listen, man, it's great that we got to spend some time together and do this thing. And I appreciate you very, very much, and hope you continue to feel better. And I'm glad that you are on the up and up and learned a lot of good lessons out of this, because we're able to share them with everybody today. So thanks for being here, Mike.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, brother. Listen, I know it's December 2021. Happy holidays, my friend. And be thankful for all the things that you have in your life. And the glass is always half full. It's really never half empty. So it was a pleasure seeing you again, my dude.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you again for, you know, New Jersey and that whole thing. The old, you know, Facebook group and everything that we have going on is going good. And yeah, thanks for putting that all together as well.
Of course, man. I mean, that's what I'm here to do, things that are good for the world. That's really what I feel in my heart. So, all right, brother, I'll talk to you.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.